Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart composed his great opera, The Marriage of Figaro, in Vienna 225 years ago. It's pretty great. But he's number three on the New York Times chief classical music critic Anthony Tomasini's top 10 list of the greatest composers of the age. Chopin, Mahler, Vivaldi, Puccini, out of luck completely. They don't make the list. Anthony Tomasini says he knows it's absurd, but it's also really interesting as an intellectual exercise to try to rank the greats. He's done it. This hour on Point, the greatest classical composers ranked 1 to 10. You can join the conversation. What really makes a composer great? What would make one greater than another? And who's your classical number one? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. How great it is. Anthony Tomasini joins us from New York, chief classical music critic for The New York Times. He's recently completed a two-week series of essays on ranking the greatest classical composers for The New York Times. Tony Tomasini, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Are you nuts? You're incredibly nuanced and subtle connoisseurs of classical music must have come after you hammer and tongs for such a rabble-rousing kind of approach to their music.
Yes, they did. We had nearly 2,700 readers' comments over the course of 2 weeks, which really was amazing. And you're right. In your intro, I heard you say that many of them said this was vulgar and crass, and many did. But many got involved in the sort of whole intellectual game aspect of this. And the only way to play any game is to take it very seriously, and that's what we did. Well, I also had a lot of comments from people who said things like, well, this is absurd, but here's my 10 top 10, and don't you dare leave out Mahler.
Right, and don't you dare, and yet so many did get left out, of course,
yes,
and we'll look at that. I mean, we know you're anything but vulgar and crass, but you took this exercise up, and how fascinating it is. How did you even begin to think? I mean, we know the big names. Everybody knows them. You're going to buy busts, you know, at Kmart of them, but how do you begin to actually rank them? What comes into play?
Well, for me, what interested me, because normally I do nothing like this. I don't rank. Mm-hmm. That's not my job as a critic. I deal with whatever I'm hearing in the context of the hearing experience and the history of the work or the artist or whatever. But for me, it was an exercise in trying to figure out, why exactly is Beethoven so great? What is the big deal about Stravinsky? Can I be precise about that? If I had to, it forces you to really think, what are the strengths and the shortcomings of each of these people? Sort of gimmick of the list makes you do that. That's what interested me, you know, the analytic process.
I can see thinking about why they're great, but then comes the really challenging thing of weighing one greatness somehow in sum against another greatness. That is a challenge. Let's go right to your number one. There's no secret about it. We hinted at the top, but it is Bach. Here's his E major prelude. Sebastian Bach's Prelude and Fugue, number 9, E major, played there by the great pianist Glenn Gould. All right, begin to explain. We're going to hear more Bach at the end of this. We're going to do number 1, then start back down at 10. But Bach, why at the top? How does he edge out the great, great, great masters?
Okay, well, again, understand this is a list of greats, not my favorites, but greats.
Understood.
And I thought that that he was also, just to clarify before we get going on this exercise, I eliminated all living composers just on the basis that we're too close to them. We just don't have enough perspective. Mm-hmm. But Bach is the beginning and the ending of everything. He came at a time where he kind of he kind of summarized everything that had happened before him and anticipated everything that was to come. Now, he didn't get involved in all the trendy things like the Rococo movement and even opera, you know, like, so in a way he was considered old-fashioned, but in his, as he saw those things happening, he dug down deeper into his own way of doing things. In the chorales alone that he wrote for the cantatas and, you know, some of the big sacred works, in the collected chorales, everything about chromatic harmony, everything about where Wagner was going is anticipated. There's nothing about harmony that you can't learn from studying just those chorales alone.
So is it musical technique you're holding up there highest, or is it something touched in the human soul by the language of music in the hands of this composer, or is it something that they point the way in the evolution? How do you rank each of those?
In Bach, it's all of that. It's the engineering is peerless. You know, the actual nuts and bolts of the music making, astonishing. But there has there ever been anything more profound, you know, than the Bach sacred works? And he may have not written an opera, but my goodness, the dramatic intensity of the choral scenes and the passions, the St. John Passion, the St. Matthew Passion, are riveting.
Yes.
So he really was, he just touched everything. He did everything. I think he would be the consensus choice for number one.
We're going to work our way back up the tree to Tony Tomasini's all-time number one ranked Bach. But let's go down to 10, Bartok, and you'll have to tell us why he made it in Chopin, Copland, Mahler, Mendelssohn, you know, all those who didn't make it did. But here's Bartok, number 10 on his top 10 list. Here we go. Béla Bartók, their string quartet number 3. And who did he squeak in right ahead of? And why, Tony? He's number 10. He's the bottom
yes,
of the list.
I know. Well, again, understand that my editors, who really leapt aboard this idea, said if you're going to go down this path, you have to go all the way and rank them in order.
Right.
I really stand by my choice of 10. The ranking within them, you know, it was very little fanciful, a little arbitrary.
Sure.
But Bartók pushed out people like Monteverdi, whom I really wanted to include, pushed out people like Haydn, you know, whom I wanted to include. Bartók, why? Because at the beginning of the 20th century, when Schoenberg revolutionized everything with 12-tone, eventually devising his 12-tone technique, Bartók showed another way. He said, you don't have to go down that path and you can still be incredibly modern and incredibly cutting edge. The other incredibly influential thing he did was his exploration of folk music, of Eastern Europe. You know, this wasn't just like other composers, like with little gypsy tunes from Budapest cafes. He went up into the mountains and really found the real indigenous, strange stuff. And infiltrated in a way his voice, all of his works, and it laid the path for a lot of people who followed him, like Lou Harrison or Golahov today. You know, Oswaldo Golahov, you know, like
sure,
today
with those Hungarian folk idioms brought right in next to Beethoven, kind of string voices. Bartók.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's take a quick turn because we've got 10 to get through. Here's Wagner, Prelude to the Valkyrie. Number 9 on Tony Tomasini's list, Richard Wagner with the prelude to the Valkyrie there from the Ring Cycle. Wagner makes your list, and again, him and others, why?
Wagner, staggering genius, a very unpleasant, unadmirable man, but an incredible genius. And in a way, he was the true one of the real inheritors of Beethoven, that Beethoven's legacy intimidated all the romantic composers who came after him, who kept trying to write sonatas and big symphonies and stuff. Wagner said, no, the way to really honor Beethoven with those big architectural spans of pieces is to write opera. You know, in a way, he thought that's where it was going. The craft in Wagner is often under-recognized. The ingenuity of the contrapuntal writing, for example, the sophistication of the harmony, because we're so swept up by these epic, mythic stories and the musical, dramatic storytelling. But he's an absolute master. People as remote as Debussy would have been impossible without Wagner's example.
He was a favorite of German nationalists, i.e. even Nazis. Did politics come into play in your rankings?
Only I had fun and I got criticized. Wagner and Verdi were kind of equal in my mind. And I had to figure out, well, who gets top billing? And I thought, well, Verdi was such a good guy and founded a retirement home for musicians that still operates in Milan. And Wagner was such a creep that I thought, just to punish him, I'd... But, you know, politics itself, Wagner had terrible bigotry and anti-Semitism, as many German intellectuals of his time did. But you can't blame him for the people that embraced him, you know, in the 20th century, or the movements that embraced him.
But you've given him a little ding there, putting him behind Verdi,
who stands at
number 8.
He deserves that
dig. Wagner at number 9. We're going right through the top 10 of Anthony Tomasini's chief classical music critic for the New York Times list of greatest classical composers of the age. A little more Wagner here. We will come back and work our way right back up to the top. You can join us. What do you think of the whole idea, the top 10 of classical greats? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's Wagner's Feuerzauber, Magic Fire Music, the Vienna Philharmonic in 2004. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about the greatest classical composers of the age and ranking them 1 through 10 with chief classical music critic for the New York Times, Anthony Tomasini. He joins us from New York. Behind me right now, Verdi's Falstaff. Of course, his final opera, written just 4 years before his death, based on Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor and scenes from Henry IV. Performed here in 1956, Philharmonic Choir and Orchestra, famous performance conducted by the legendary Herbert von Karajan, comes in number 8, that is, Giuseppe Verdi, on Tony Tomasini's top 10 list. You can join our conversation this hour. What do you think of the whole idea, the top 10 of classical greats? Would you begin to rank them? Is that cool? Is that crazy? Can we have fun, learn something, just thinking about it? And how would you begin to rank the greats? What would you compare in their music, in their impact? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tony Tomasini, Verdi, number 8. How do you put him there?
Yes, well, you could make a case that opera is a different animal, and maybe the opera should have been a separate list, a separate contest. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel that way. I love when you talk with James Levine about operas. He'll say, Falstaff, it's such a great piece. He thinks of it as a musical piece, and so do I. You know, they really are pieces. And Verdi wrote a lot of great, great pieces. He, in his whole career, had this tension between the Italian opera tradition that he inherited with set arias and recitatives and cabalettas and cavatinas and things like that and ensembles. And part of him wanted to push against that and break away. And gradually during his whole career, he did that until in this final opera, Falstaff, I felt like he was saying, look, I'm almost 80 years old. I can do whatever I want. I'm Giuseppe Verdi, and I'm just forgetting about all that stuff. There's nothing remotely like an aria in this whole opera. It's like almost like a gossamer piece of fabric, you know, that's stitched together out of a thousand little pieces. It's absolutely magical.
1893.
But what a piece.
What a piece. But when you listen and you're thinking of ranking in this composer, what are you listening for? Technical quality? Color? It's opera. Humanity? What?
I mean, again, all those things. It's the technique, a little bit like Wagner, the technique, the sheer technique in Verdi is underestimated, I think. His harmonic sophistication, the greatest fugue in opera is the fugue that ends Falstaff. I mean, but it, ultimately, it's a little elusive. And influence was something I really struggled with. I mean, how much does influence really matter? Schoenberg was the most influential composer of the 20th century, by far. Everyone who came after him had to deal with 12-tone music.
Yes.
What do they feel about that? Does that make him one of the 10 greatest? So it's really, in almost every case, it was like a mixture of influence and technique. And popularity is not to be laughed at. You know, these operas of Verdi are still so central to our lives and to the repertoire of every opera company, that's not for nothing. You know, there are good reasons for that.
It's a great exercise. Let's bring in our listeners, if I may. Anthony Tomasini with the New York Times joins us. Mike is calling from West Newton, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Tomasini.
Hi.
My question is this. You made much of the fact that this is an intellectual exercise at the beginning of the show. I certainly can understand. I have my preferences, and I'm sure obviously you do. What I'm not getting is what's particularly intellectual about this kind of aesthetic judgment. Certainly aesthetics admits of intellectualism, but I don't think making a hierarchy has anything intellectual about it. And I might be wrong, so I'd appreciate if you'd clarify this.
That's great, Mike. Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, well, that's a very fair point. I mean, it gets to a definition of what is intellectual. I do urge listeners to go to the New York Times website because for part of this project, I made 5 videos where the video crew at the Times, which was very good, came over and I sat at my piano at home and played things and analyzed pieces and tried to show what in the precise things in this music that so fascinated me, so impressed me. So in a way, that's my sort of defense about the intellectual content of it, because I actually dealt with the music in very minute and particular ways.
At the keyboard, on video, so you can hear you sort of working it through with your own fingers as you consider. There's a link to that on our website as well. You can get to Tony Tomasini and all that. The ranking part, well, it encourages the exercise anyway, and maybe that is a kind of value in itself.
It's amazing.
Yes, please.
I'm sorry.
No.
It's amazing to me how many very good musicians that I know wrote to me and got involved with this. For example, a composer, Derek Bermel, who's a terrific composer but also a very, very good clarinetist, agonized over his top 10 list. He finally pushed out Brahms to make room for Verdi. Brahms, who wrote 4 of the great seminal works for clarinet, probably the 2 greatest sonatas in the whole repertoire. But he had several contemporary composers, Messiaen and Ligeti on his list. And he just had to have Verdi. I thought that was charming.
Maybe it's the very artifice of it, which Mike is questioning, but it makes us think it through. You mentioned Brahms. He's number 7 on your list. Let's go right to it. Here's Brahms' 2nd piano, B-flat minor.
Thank you.
Johannes Brahms, second piano concerto B-flat major. He composed it between 1878 and 1881. He described it, he called it himself the Long Terror, and maybe you can hear a bit of why there. Tony, we'll get your thoughts on that. Let me get a caller right here on Brahms. Okay. James is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. James, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Tom. Nice to speak with you.
You too.
I just want to make a couple of comments. I'm a classical flute player, and I think overall, you know, this ranking is excellent. You know, we should do it again and again as long as we're doing it in a friendly, intellectual, emotional way. It's a good way to learn about music. But also, you know, in playing Brahms as a classical flute player, my brother hates Brahms, but until you play something and you study it, you can't always, you know, engulf that and really understand it and learn the soul of the piece. And I think that's a huge thing. You know, what is your relationship with the music? Then to comment on Bach, he's definitely my top 10 because when you study music, understand the perfection of the relationship of all these intervals, it's amazing. But something so mechanical is so emotional. That's what's so amazing about it. And then one last thought, you know, when we pick things apart, you know, everything within us is kind of in our environment, like the trees, nature.
Yes.
And in picking it apart, we actually just can diffuse the joy of it. So it's really something very, very simple can be just as beautiful as something very complicated.
Thank you, James. It's a good warning. We're certainly celebrating today as we pick apart a little, but absolutely celebrating at the same time. Tony, what about James' notion that maybe one can't judge ultimately unless one's a musician who's played it, who knows it from the inside out? How does that come in? How do musicians respond to your ranking?
I think people are always, who are not trained musicians, who love music, are always beating themselves up and thinking, oh, I'm not getting something, I'm missing. But I think our ears work much, much better than we think they do, even just intuitively. I think people are, but I find that people crave with music, wanting to know how does it work. So in the videos, when I sit down and I say, listen to this, now listen to this,
yes.
I've gotten amazing reactions, reactions to that. I do disagree a little bit that I do think that sometimes analyzing, I know what he means, that analyzing something can sort of reduce it to a bunch of parts, you know, but I actually always find, I love to find out more about the details, about the inner workings of it. It increases my feeling for it, my love of it, I think.
And simplicity versus complexity, clearly from your list, they can both drive one right up your rankings. I mean, not all the pieces by these great, great composers are tremendously complex. Some are. Some certainly are not.
Now, Brahms, I was talking about the Beethoven legacy. Mm-hmm. Beethoven took these forms, the symphony, the sonata, the chamber, the string quartet, and just made them the ultimate. But these are all related to the classical era. And the Romantic period, all those music got so passionate and personal, and those forms started breaking down. So composers like Schumann really struggled to continue to write symphonies, you know, in the Beethoven manner. It was really, really difficult. Brahms, a little bit later, came along and said, well, I'm going to do it. I can find my own, you know, a harmonically adventurous but new way to keep this going. And my goodness, it's the second piano concerto of Brahms and a colossal example of doing just that.
Absolutely glorious. Sarah in Barrie, Vermont. Sarah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm a pianist. And first of all, of course, leaving Chopin out already seemed like sacrilege to me. But setting my status as a pianist aside, I know you said in your articles that Chopin wasn't striving for greatness. He did music more as an emotional expression, personal expression. But in the end, I think, I don't know, to me, greatness is really how many people love the composer. And, you know, to me, Chopin, even someone who isn't interested in classical music, whenever they hear him, they're not going to forget him. And so I think maybe Chopin should have been on the list.
Right. I worship and adore the music of Chopin, and I think the preludes of Chopin alone are just so harmonically sophisticated as to be miraculous. But you have to understand, I had the limit of 10.
Right,
I had to find ways to push somebody out. And my excuse with Chopin was that he was like a poet of the piano. He was so personal. That stuff just poured out of him, and he wrote it down as fast as he could. Some of it sounds like almost written out improvisations. I think he didn't mean that he didn't want his music to strike people as great, but I think he didn't care about greatness or that whole legacy. The whole Beethoven thing meant nothing to him. Passed right over him. He could have cared less. He liked Bach. He liked Mozart. He loved Italian opera, Bellini, and that was it. He wasn't even particularly interested in the other music of his composer colleagues.
Play it and love it, Sarah. I've got to drive on here if we're going to make this top 10. Speaking of striving for greatness, you've got plenty of that going on. And anything but Brahms and Chopin here. Igor Stravinsky, number 6 on Tony's list. Igor Stravinsky conducting conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic Choir and Orchestra in 1965 with his Symphony of Psalms right there. Stravinsky sort of bent everybody's head around, and I want to come to the explanation for that, but I want to put him right up against a very different sound, Tony, then we'll go to both. He's 6. Hold it right there. Here's Debussy, number 5 on Tony Tomasini's top 10 list. This is La Terrasse des Audiences du Clair de Lune.
Because it's static doesn't mean there's no tension. It's incredibly tense. But it's like you're held thinking, what's going on? It's like the whole world changed. You don't believe it. It must be going somewhere else, and sure enough, it goes to this.
I should have forewarned right there. That's you, Tony, on tape at the keyboard talking about the terraces of moonlit audiences. What a title. Stravinsky and Debussy, we've just got a couple of minutes before the break, but give us your explanation, your thinking.
Yes, Debussy, to come after like 300 years of pulsating Germanic music, to come along and write this stuff that was static and harmonically amorphous was completely radical. It changed everything. And he found a way to have tension within stasis, and that was uncanny. And one of the people he profoundly influenced was Stravinsky. Would have been impossible without Debussy. Stravinsky went through different periods. His first, there was the radical Stravinsky of Paris of the early days. Then there was the neoclassical Stravinsky of the Symphony of Psalms. And my goodness, what a piece that is! Bernstein said that Alleluia and that the last movement that set so forlornly. If Stravinsky had written nothing but those chords, we'd still remember him. And Uncle Lenny could be get over exaggerated in things, but boy, in a way,
right,
I agree. Yeah,
Anthony Tomasini, the great classical music critic for the New York Times, is with us with his top 10 list. We're just over the midway hump with Stravinsky at 6, Debussy at number 5. We'll go out of this segment with one of the most recognizable Debussy pieces today. Named for the poem of the same name by symbolist poet Paul Verlaine, Clair de Lune embodies that cool harmonic palette of Debussy. You can join this conversation. What about ranking the greatest composers of all time? Would you have Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, 1, 2, 3? Would that be easy or not? What do you see? What would be on your list? And how do you begin to think about what Anthony Tomasini has himself done here for us? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Enjoy this. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Thank you.
des Rassen die Ketten, schlafen die Menschen in ihren Betten.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the greatest classical composers of the age and ranking them 1 through 10 with chief classical music critic for the New York Times, Anthony Tomasini. He's done it. He's laid it out there in public. Now the whole world responds. Behind us right here, Schubert's Im Dorfe. Schubert's from his Winterreise song cycle. It's sung here by and performed by Ronald Dowd, tenor, and Jonathan Winther on piano. You can join the conversation this hour. We are up in the short list now. 4, 3, 2, 1 to come. What do you think of the whole idea? What do we learn from this exercise? 800-423-8255. Tony Tomasini joins us from New York. And Tony, we're really getting down to it here.
Yes.
Schubert, it's absolutely beautiful, but he's over the hump. He's in the top of your list. Now it has to be really rarefied criteria. What's going on for Schubert here in your ranking?
Well, we had this problem with what I call the Vienna Four. Are we actually going to give 4 places on this list to 4 people who came from roughly a 75-year period working in Vienna, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert?
Yes.
And somebody had to go, and I picked on poor Haydn, you know,
yes,
who was the father of everything. But maybe his influence is carried out by his disciples, his student, yeah, Beethoven and Mozart. But Schubert, maybe my personal feelings got a little bit better of me here, but I think he was an astonishing master. And just getting going at 30, to die at 31.
Yes.
This song is incredible, and if you think about it, that the wanderer on this miserable, lonely winter's journey,
mm-hmm,
comes upon a village. People are sleeping. Nobody's paying attention to him. And he thinks the melody has an almost lullaby-like quality. But the first line says, the watchdogs are barking. They're only people who notice him.
Yeah.
And the piano part has those,
yes,
those little rumbles. That's the dogs.
It's winter. He's in the village, Imdorf, and it's just the dogs responding to him.
It's the dogs. He takes that little image of the dogs in the first line and makes it into the whole accompaniment of that song. It's astonishing. It's radical. It's really amazing.
So when you say on Schubert that you've let your personal preference come in here, how did that invade? Does he speak to something? I mean, each of us have our personality, our psyche, which intersects or touches or is touched by this music. So something in yours, and you're willing to give that weight to say, there you go, Schubert, number 4.
My list of actual personal favorites would have been a little different and probably had Britten on it and Chopin and maybe Puccini. But Schubert, I can understand what Schumann referred to as the heavenly lengths of Schubert, that sometimes things go on. He seems to lose control of the form. At the end of his life, he started taking counterpoint lessons because he thought he didn't know enough about it. But the sheer inventiveness and the mix for him of bucolic, almost childlike simplicity and utter cosmic despair and profundity anticipated everything about Mahler.
Yes.
I just respond so profoundly to that. The last the late piano sonatas, extraordinary, astonishing pieces.
All these years later, going on 2 centuries, Jan in Etna, New Hampshire, you're on the air with Anthony Tomasini.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to say that I think Vivaldi should be on the list, but that's my subjective opinion. I think that no composer evokes for me the strong emotion that I feel when I listen to Vivaldi.
There you go. Tony, to your what moves one, you know, it may be Schubert in your case, it's Vivaldi in Jan's case. That just the sheer emotional response to it.
Yeah, for me, I think my Vivaldi would have been Puccini, who I think was a masterful composer. But, oh, my goodness, do I respond to that music. He really knew a thing or two about the theater and how to write a musical drama, much more than Beethoven did, for example, with that same kind of skill. But, again, I was really trying to be intellectual and cool-headed a little bit and think, well, who really are the greats, you know, the towering figures? And Vivaldi, for me, just, you know, didn't cut it.
Jan, go on being moved, though. The list, in the end, it means everything and nothing, I suppose. Richard in Florence, South Carolina. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention that a previous caller had said something about the intellectual merit of a article like this, and mm-hmm. I wanted to say that there might be a meta-intellectual value to it.
Mm-hmm.
Publishers know that lists, like top 10 lists, get people to read articles, and so it occurred to me that maybe the order of the list doesn't matter so much as the idea that the article would get people to listen to these great works that maybe they haven't examined before.
It will win engagement, maybe, by all those minds who might not otherwise, you say, Richard.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would you put at the top of yours, Richard, while you're on it, while you're on?
Well, I'm very fond of Beethoven, and I also agree with the previous caller about Vivaldi.
Okay. We'll come to it. Tony, what do you say?
Engagement is absolutely an important, you know, consideration for all the work I do. I'm trying to engage readers. I'm trying to get them to listen to things either in a new way or listen to things they don't know. I champion contemporary music every chance I get. So engagement really – and if this is a kind of intellectual lark that can do that, that's great. You know, I'm glad it worked that way.
Let's get one more here. Bob in Milton, Massachusetts. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I agree with the last caller, too. And I think it's great fun, the whole exercise. But I don't know how Anthony could leave out the composer of the greatest piano concerto, the composer of the greatest violin concerto, or the composer, without question, of the greatest classical dance music. Tchaikovsky, I'm talking about, who also wrote a couple of terrific symphonies, who wrote some operas that are still being performed, and just had a terrific range and connected emotionally more than intellectually, but I think that's more valuable.
Bob, who would you bump to put Tchaikovsky on the list? Would you bump Bartok, Wagner, Verdi,
that's
Brahms?
That's my question.
Bob, who would you bump?
I'd put him in the top five and choose from somebody in the bottom five.
Somebody has to go, but not Tchaikovsky. And Bob makes the argument on his accomplishments and, again, the emotional power that for Bob here, Tony.
I think I would go further. Not only does Tchaikovsky engage us emotionally with the sweep and power of his music, but I think he's a great master. I think he's a very, very great craftsman. Not for me in the chamber music. That's where he really kind of lost control, I think, and that stuff kind of meanders for me. I sort of finagled my way out of including more of the romantic era composers by saying that they were so personal, that it was so subjective in a way, their music, so personally visionary, that it in a way it doesn't strive at greatness. But again, I was struggling for ways to make room for other composers. So maybe that was maybe a little bit of a finagling way out of it. But yeah, Tchaikovsky is a great, great composer. But again, for me, I didn't, even trying to be cool-headed about it, I didn't quite see it. And I would pose again the question you just posed to him, that who would go from that list?
Well, we've worked our way up from 10, headed toward the top three, and we're just about into maybe the super greats here, but we've come up from 10. Bartok, Wagner, Verdi, Brahms, Stravinsky, Debussy, Schubert. And now we come to those really towering names. Let's listen here from part two of Symphony 41 from Mozart's The Jupiter Symphony. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's from the Jupiter Symphony, composed in the summer of 1788. He died in 1791. How do you put these against one another? I mean, now we're really up there. Mozart behind Beethoven, Mozart behind Bach. How do you decide?
Well, this was a little bit arbitrary, maybe, but Bach, I think, was a pretty good consensus choice for number one. Beethoven versus Mozart, that was really hard. Mozart, the argument for Mozart as the greatest composer in history would be that he was the master in both the symphonic chamber music, you know, realm and opera. He is absolutely at the top of the heap in both. Opera drove, for me, everything that he did. A lot of the piano concertos, the piano sonatas sound like just opera to me. He was not so interested, even as Haydn was, in these big architectural symphonies, except for these last three, that where he really, he started writing the last three, 39, 40, and then this one that we're hearing, the Jupiter. There was no particular, as far as we know, there was no reason to write them. It wasn't like he had a performance lined up. He just sat down and wrote them all more or less together. And in a way, he was thinking, well, I can do this too. I can really write that symphonic, architectural, complex, you know, music that would point right to Beethoven. And I think if he had lived more than 35 years, he would have continued, you know, to write things like this. But ultimately, he was Mr. Showbiz. He was nowhere more at home than in the opera house.
Maybe I'm a prisoner of the showbiz part. You call it showbiz. You know, I think of Mozart, that ecstatic genius, that sort of utter liberation when he just lets it roll. And Beethoven's so great, but the heaviness, I don't know. Here was Mozart, you know, in this, he's broke in debt, falling out of favor with his fans when he composed this. One of his greatest creations ever, but the freedom of Mozart, so compelling.
It is, but those extraordinarily strange Beethoven pieces just linger with us. One thing I've thought is that Beethoven survives even a bad performance. The yes. architecture of the music is so amazing. Mozart does not. A Mozart piano sonata, you know, or a piano concerto can sound like tinkle, tinkle, you know, nothing if it's not, doesn't have the right style. I think that's partly why Beethoven had a little edge for me, in that we're still, the fourth piano concerto, my goodness, what a strange cosmic piece. We're still grappling, you know, with all those works.
All right, then, let's go to Beethoven. Number two, we're almost to the top of this list. You write about Beethoven, his mysticism, his poetic reverie, the wildness of his music, unfathomable and amazing. Here's Opus 127, number 12, E-flat, Beethoven, the first movement. Great Beethoven, number two on Tony Tomasini's list. Speak to Beethoven, Tony.
Well, this piece is, it's really a kind of personal story with it, that when I was a kid in the 60s studying piano very seriously, I was, even then, the late works of Beethoven were not played as often as you think, as they are today. I was sort of scared of them. And I bought a recording in the last five string quartets, of which is the first. And I put this on. I thought, this is what I was so afraid of, this music. But yet, the more I listen to that piece, it begins with a kind of almost fanfare-like thing. But it's, the rhythms are staggered. It seems like a kind of strange, mystical sort of fanfare. Then it segues into that kind of easygoing, deceptively easygoing contrapuntal weavings, and you think, is there a theme in this piece? And it's really, in this late period, he just went to a place beyond era, beyond period, beyond style. It still sounds new to us. It still sounds radical.
We are so lucky to be able to choose at the top of your list between these. Let's go straight from it. Our time is short. Goodbye, Beethoven. Please come back. But here, Bach. This is Mass in B minor. Let's listen. Bach, and we could go to tears easily. One more call, Marianne, Potsdam, New York. Our time is short. Marianne, Bach.
Wow. That I made is and am making is, I believe the exercise that you've gone through here in and of itself is brilliant. In that, for folks who have a fire burning but maybe is not fanned too highly for classical music, the neophyte, I would suggest that you suggest to folks to go out and listen to one of these composers live once a month for the rest of the year and then report back. And I believe just that exercise in itself is something that that would be a contribution to attendance of live music in our country, and I think this exercise is fantastic.
Marianne, thanks for your call. So infinitely alive, infinitely alive, this Bach we're hearing right now, Tony.
Right. The opening chords of that Kyrie, I mean, on the surface it seems austere, very Baroque, and yet the harmonies are so wrenching. Is anything in Mahler more tormented and anguished than those chords? Then it goes into this absolutely poised yet incredibly intense contrapuntal fabric, you know, where he works out these long threads of melodic lines that are, it's just ingenious. I mean, could any composer in the history of music other than Bach have composed this piece?
By your list, so. Not. Tormented, anguished, human, beautiful. You were brave to take up this exercise, and you're generous to share it with us, Tony. We're really
Thank
grateful.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
It was
Thank
really
you.
Terrific. Links to all of Tony's video and pieces at onpointradio.org. Anthony Tomasini, Chief Classical Music Critic for the New York Times. Our deep gratitude to you for doing this and for being with us. We'll go out with one more piece from number one, Bach, Mass in B minor. This is the end of part three of the four parts of the Great Mass in B minor, performed by the Netherlands Chamber Choir and the Orchestra of the 18th Century, conducted by Franz Bruggen. Anthony Tomasini, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for being here. This is On Point.